the entire earth, with her trees and her waters, with her animals, with her men and her gods, calls from within your breasts. Nikos Kazantzakis. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back, and thank you for the support. Please feel free, if you're a newcomer, though, to go back and avail yourself of our backlog of episodes. But this week, we will be covering southern or peninsular India and Sri Lanka between the years of 6000 to 4000 BCE. I do want to caution that there may be some technical issues with this. I'm having to record on my laptop due to there's been some storms in the area, and I don't want to use my main PC because I'm worried that I might lose power, or I have my computer surge protected, but I'm just kind of nervous. So if the episode's rather short, it's because I got very worried about the weather, and I'm just trying to get this recorded and set to load before the weather turns too bad. You guys might hear the lightning in the background now. I'm not sure if that's being picked up by the microphone or not. But yeah, so just keep that in mind for this week's episode. But before we dive into the meat, or the primary focus of this week's episode, there were a couple of things I did forget to go over. One's from last week's episode, and one was from an episode a couple of weeks ago. I forgot to mention last week, when I was going over the differences in artifacts, in last week's episode, between the sites in the Indus Valley and the sites in Baluchistan, there was one thing that I forgot to mention that the Indus Valley sites did not have that show up in a few of the Baluchistan sites, and that is that they have found no button or stamp seals at these early Indus sites. Now, eventually they do begin to be used in the Indus Valley sites, but during the course of this season, none have been found outside of, again, a couple of Baluchistan sites and Marigar. And speaking of Marigar, that brings me to the other thing I forgot to mention a couple of episodes ago. Though I believed I touched on it during one of our domestication episodes at the start of this season, but I did not mention again to remind you guys. There have been traces of tree cotton fiber that were found, I believe, during the Marigar III period. They were found in some of the beads and jewels that they had, or jewelry, not necessarily jewels, but between some of the beads and other decoration found in some of those Marigar caches. This is some of the earliest evidence of cotton use in the old world. And of course, cotton will become one of the major goods made by the Indus Valley civilization, and indeed many other states and polities and peoples from the subcontinent. So it's extremely likely that the people living in the Marigar region first domesticated the plant there. So I just wanted to kind of tie that back in and just make sure you guys were aware. Now, let's go ahead and move back over to our primary focus for this week's episode, and that is the peoples of southern India / Sri Lanka. Now, just as a quick refresher, people have been moving into and out of the area essentially since Homo sapiens left Africa and first reached the subcontinent. That said, there doesn't appear to be too many areas or sites that see repeated or, you know, long-term use, abandonment, and then reoccupation. At least that is until around 15,000 BC or so. Now, after that time, the human population, or the permanent human population in the area, grows in the region. Now, it's very probable that there was a permanent population prior to that point. But due to the tropical nature of the area, it's very possible that what evidence there was just degraded. We've talked about this before, but more humid, hotter environments don't, they're not the best at preserving things, and especially things like wood artifacts. So, and you know, wood's very important for humans for a lot of reasons, and we've talked about that before. But so, yeah, that's definitely one of the reasons that we probably just don't have too much evidence. Now, there's also another possibility to explain this lack of evidence. The populations there could have been living along the coast primarily. And as the water level rose to modern or near modern levels, people began to move further inland and older sites were flooded. In fact, we know this is something that's still going on during the period of this season. For that, we have a very big example, the island of Sri Lanka. There's a very thin strip of land and islands known as Rama's Bridge between the island and the tip of southern India. At most points in times, this was a full land bridge between the two bodies. However, around 5,000 BC or so, large portions of this bridge was disconnected by rising sea levels. Now, travel between the two regions was still possible with small boats and dinghies and canoes and things like that, but it did make it a little bit harder. Now, at later points, the bridge does reemerge more, but from this point forward in our story, it's usually been submerged. Still, culturally and materially, the two areas continue to share a lot of similarities in the archaeological record during this season, next season, and I think probably the season after that. They do, of course, eventually develop much different societies, or at least material cultures. Though links between them are always going to remain. Sometimes they're closer to each other than other periods, but that's all stuff that we'll have to discuss later, but I'm just kind of giving you a general overview. But for right now, even though, again, they're probably not as regular direct contact, they're still in contact, and there's still a lot of overlap between Sri Lanka and southern India. For this material culture, they've really only partially entered into the Neolithic. They have begun to use microlithic blades for their tools and weapons. But most of the other items associated with the Neolithic toolkit do not appear until next season. They don't have pottery this season, or at least if they do, it's not being produced by them. They may have raided or traded for pottery from peoples to the north, but there's no evidence that, if there is any, there's a lot of it. So they're an aceramic people as well. And of course, they are still hunting and gathering as their primary mode of subsistence. Now, there is some debate if agriculture was practiced in this region at this early date, and if it was, to what extent. Now, I'm of the opinion that there was probably an early stage of proto-agriculture or horticulture being practiced in some places in southern India. The reason I think this is that by the end of next season, which will probably be about 2000 BC, there is solid evidence that plants native to parts of southern India are beginning to be seen at other sites, especially to the north in the Indus Valley. So even if they're not fully domesticated this season, people are probably starting them off towards the long road to being domesticated. The biggest example that I can think of for this is black pepper. It's native to the Malabar coast of southern India, which is that little strip that runs parallel to the Western Ghats, which, remember, the Ghats are the mountains that kind of form the point of southern India. There's like a little strip of coastline to the foothills of the Ghats, and there's the Western Ghats, which kind of run, of course, north to south, or excuse me, northwest to south east to the point of the Indian subcontinent. And you've got the Eastern Ghats, which run from the tip to the northwest. So they're kind of like those, essentially, they're forming an acute angle at the tip of southern India. But the Malabar coast is where pepper initially comes from. And of course, later it will expand out of there, but that's where it was at least initially native to. Now, I'll talk more about black pepper during next season's domestication episode, but that's just a big example and one of the reasons why I think, you know, they're probably getting towards domestication on their own. They're developing their own local crops with what they have available. And of course, today, black pepper is still the most sold and traded spice in the world. Now, I couldn't find any mention of domesticated animals being managed in the region during this season. And I would guess the main reason for this would be due to the tropical environment. It's possible that sheep and goats are spreading from the Middle East. Of course, we already know that, that sheep and goats are being spread from the Middle East to other regions. And they've already been here for, you know, at least 1,000 years or so, probably more than that in some cases. But due to the tropical environment, that's something those animals aren't typically, you know, associated with. And that will change because there are several breeds of goats that exist today that are right at home in tropical parts of India. And, you know, there are a lot of mountains there, perfect for rearing goats. Doesn't appear to be that they had been bred to adapt to that region during this season. That is going to change, though. Now, there is plenty of evidence of cattle bones found, of course, all throughout southern India, the same way you find them at other sites. The question is, though, are these domesticated cattle? That's debatable. Remember, it's really hard to tell the difference in, especially in early cases, of differences between domesticated animals and wild animals. We do know that local Zebu cattle are interbred with Asian cattle very early. And it's entirely possible that the cattle they were hunting were examples of these crossbreeding attempts. They were also probably hunting wild herds of Zebu cattle too. Not a surprise. Like it's there might be a mix of the two. At the very least, they were hunting wild cattle. But that is just, you know, that's kind of what we have in terms of domesticated animal evidence for the region. So southern India is kind of at this weird point where it's half in the Mesolithic and half in the Neolithic. Now the Neolithic, of course, is approaching quicker. But it's still going to be a while before we get to that. Now, as I mentioned, there's no evidence of pottery. That's also, there's no evidence of copper tools, at least in this area for this season. That should be a surprise. Copper beads are, you know, only beginning to show up in small numbers at places further north. Though, from what I understand, and I may be wrong, and I may have kind of gotten the sources a little confused, this region, despite having access to, you know, some decent types of, or I should say a wide variety of metals, southern India doesn't really have a Bronze Age. That's maybe due to, you know, people to the north kind of monopolizing bronze and, you know, trying to use it more for them. I think copper does exist in southern India, but I don't know that they had access to tin. Now, they will have an Iron Age. In fact, they're kind of like parts of West Africa or sub-Saharan Africa that they likewise did not have a Bronze Age, at least an independent Bronze Age. They kind of learned to make iron, and they learned to make it well. And the same is true for South India. They kind of developed their own metallurgy based on working iron. Now, once they have iron, you know, they can get bronze at a little easier clip, probably due to it, bronze not being as valuable anymore. You know, it's not something that you have to hold on to for dear life as a strategic resource. But I'm jumping way ahead there. I was just kind of pointing out one of the big differences in the region that we'll see. Now, unfortunately, like I said, due to the environment, it's kind of hard to find a lot of artifacts. Also, South India hasn't had quite the level of excavation from these earlier periods that North India has. Now, that is changing. There's a lot of archaeological surveys done in southern India these days. However, they're usually looking at more medieval / classical time periods. Now, I'm sure eventually they'll find, you know, earlier sites that are part of, you know, mythology or, you know, more, I should say, mythological history, you know, things like legendary kings or rulers, that kind of thing. Because those, you know, there are definitely parts of southern India that are talked about in numerous sources, not just sources in India. Sources outside of India mention places that are likely part of southern India. I think Ophir in the Bible is probably thought to be along like the southwestern coast of India. I think it's Ophir. It might be a different O name. I can't remember. But I'm sure eventually we will learn a lot more about southern India's history. There is one other big thing to talk about and kind of use this to kind of guess about a little bit more of what's happening. There is today, or at least I should say, most of the people living in southern India speak some form of a Dravidian language. I think that's around 250 million people, which is not small by any means. It's only like 20%, I think, of India's population, maybe a little bit more than that. But again, still a huge number of people speak some form of Dravidian. And there is a few branches today. I think there's South, South Central, Central languages. They're all kind of either in the southern tip of India up to the middle of the country. And then you've kind of got like these pockets of Dravidian languages surrounded by speakers of some type of Indo-European languages. But there are some spoken also in Pakistan, as well as to the northeast in Nepal and Bangladesh as well, I believe. So, very widespread. And there is thought that perhaps at this earlier period, Dravidian was much more widespread, that perhaps everyone in the subcontinent spoke some form of Proto-Dravidian. Now, that is debated. There's a lot of controversy regarding that. And we'll go over some of that stuff later. It's not kind of something that's important to this episode. That's probably something we'll cover more when we talk about India probably next season. At this point, though, the language, if it exists, is still in the kind of the Proto-Dravidian form. And that would be right at, it would probably be you know, somewhere between 5,000 to 3,000 BC. I think 3,000 BC is about the latest that Proto-Dravidian could have been spoken before it began to subdivide into its various branches. But I think probably the earlier date, or at least the mid-date, probably the 4th millennium is probably this right around the time we're looking for. But we know that Dravidian was spoken more widely, kind of to the north, to the northwest, in places like Pakistan, because the place names share a lot of similarities with place names in the south. They have the same endings, like Vali, and there are a couple of others that I should have written down, but I forgot to do so. So there is evidence of Dravidian place names, even in places where modern day very few or no Dravidian speakers inhabit. These could just be coincidences, but that's extremely unlikely, in my opinion. Though, again, I am not a linguist. I can't go against a couple of centuries worth of linguistic work from a whole discipline. So I won't do that. But regardless, if you go by the kind of the breakdown that where language is most diverse in terms of like where things overlap is kind of a language's birthplace, we're looking probably dead center in India, where the Dravidian language was originally spoken. And then, of course, it spread, all out kind of in a radius from there. I think the central branch and the south central branch and the north and south, they're all fairly close to each other. They have like a weird kind of circle kind of going on. But, central India is where you see the closest, I guess, cluster of the various branches all together. We'll talk more about, linguistics later. There is another thing that I want to talk about, and that is about, they're called ash mounds. What these are is debated, at least what the earliest versions of them are. You'll sometimes see them called cinder mounds, but these are man-made features, essentially. The dates on this are all over the place. I've seen some that say the earliest ash mounds are in date to around 8,000 BC, but I see that some of those dates are saying, oh, that's way too early, even though carbon dating shows that they're from that time. But there is some suggestion that maybe these earliest examples are not what you see later. There's just kind of a quirk of, how they're made that they're similar, but they're probably not related at all in any way. So that's a little bit of a debate. But you find these spread out in mostly through southern India, specifically around the modern Indian state of Karnataka. And this is actually to the north of the kind of the Malabar coast region. But essentially, these were man-made mounds where people would burn a collection of wood and animal matter, bones, dung, all this other stuff, and kind of build up these artificial mounds. And what the exact reason for is not known, but they're considered a kind of form of Neolithic monumental architecture. And some of them are fairly large, though again, most of those kind of come from a later period. And they're spread throughout most of southern India, though again, some places only have like one or two. And then you have, where is now the modern state of Karnataka, which is, you have a much higher concentration. And what these are is kind of debated, as I said. There are some that link it to an early form of communal sacrifice, you know, where they're burning this stuff to offer it to spirit or gods or what have you, to kind of, you know, pray for, you know, future, basically to return, I guess, the things you're offering, like new versions of it. There are some that connect it with funerals of some type, that perhaps they were burning, you know, bodies of specific people who had died, or maybe groups of people who had died, perhaps in disasters and things like that. And it's a way to kind of cleanse, you know, the community or those that had died, so they could have a peaceful afterlife, or just not return to cause them problems, kind of lay them to rest, as it were. There's also just the theory that it may have just been a form of kind of trash removal, to kind of just clean your community ritually, or spiritually, I guess, and say, like, this is all old. We don't need this pollution near us anymore, so we're going to discard it through fire, which is, of course, a cleansing force in many societies, that it is something that washes, you know, in some ways cleaner than water, though, again, all that's debated. I know in later periods, it's associated with spots where Rakshasa had been defeated or destroyed, and Rakshasa are kind of like, they show up in various religions in India, in Hindu scriptures, Buddhist, Jainism, and, you know, essentially they're kind of evil entities, sort of demons, though they're not always evil. It kind of depends, but most of them oppose, like, the Hindu gods or the devas, so they're usually considered evil. And essentially, these were sites where they had been cast down or destroyed after a battle with a god or a hero or what have you. Though, again, these are probably later stories, like, just to explain, oh, this is where such and such was destroyed, or, you know, where he fell, you know, after a battle with the gods. I don't think any of them are linked to specific deities. That's just a kind of a way to explain it away, at least, you know, later. That's all stuff we'll go over, you know, when we talk about different Hindu epics and things like that. Anyway, so again, the Ashbounds are very mysterious. We don't know much about them. And again, there's the debate on if they're even all connected with each other. Again, very long period of time. The earliest ones, again, could be as old as 8,000 BC, or they are as old as 8,000 BC, but they're in a different region, and you don't see too many of them. And then where you see most of them in where they're concentrated, and during the time period where most of them were made, it's possible that these are just coincidences. Or, you know, it was maybe a ritual that was abandoned and then reestablished later. It's impossible to say. That is kind of it for this episode. There is a little bit more I want to talk about with Southern India and Sri Lanka. I'll finish up here next week. Then we'll move kind of along the Ganges plain and talk about places there. I'm kind of worried about the weather. It's getting really windy outside and my lights have been flickering. So I really need to get this episode, you know, recorded and, well, not recorded, but posted, so in case my internet goes out. So I definitely want this up at the regular time. Thank you all for joining me. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X/Twitter. You can also leave a comment on the YouTube video, and I'll do my best to respond when comment is left, though sometimes it may take me a day or two if I'm not viewing those. But yeah, thank you all for joining me again. I appreciate the support. Please like, subscribe, download, rate 5 stars wherever you listen to your podcasts and or watch them on YouTube. I'm very close to 225 on YouTube. Getting closer to getting maybe a couple of cents for every listen I get, which would be nice. But regardless, I'm going to keep doing the show. I enjoy it a lot. I have a lot of fun making it. And I have a lot of fun hearing back from you guys. So thank you all so, so much. I'll see you all next time. Have a good rest of your day, rest of your week, all that stuff. Peace.